Okay, well, thank you, everyone, for being here, and thank you, Tony, and others for the organization. I'm Greg Carbone. I'm happy to join you this afternoon. I've got about 25 slides. This is you know, we've moved into the PowerPoint world where you can't see somebody's slide tray anymore, so you don't know how long it's going to go. So, and beyond that, we're doing it digitally. So I'm gonna tell you that I have 25 slides. I like to spend typically about a minute per slide on average. And that will leave us plenty of time for questions. So I've purposely structured today's presentation to allow plenty of time for your questions. And in these kind of talks, I find that to be most beneficial for all parties, that hopefully I will stimulate some questions. Hopefully you have other things that are on your mind that you'd like some discussion about, and I think we'll have plenty of time to do that. Tony, if you can advance to the next slide. I'm going to show a lot of slides today that come from the IPCC report or from literature that the IPCC report, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report of the fourth assessment on climate change that was released in February of 2007. I think in all cases, the graphics that I have borrowed from that report are cited and sourced at the bottom, so you'll see that. And I start with this first one on the components of climate change, the climate change process, simply to sort of provide an overview, much of which I think you may be familiar with in terms of the component parts, but I also do it particularly now in order to talk about the parts of this story that I want to say a few things about today. In particular, my focus is going to be on the top center of the diagram that illustrates the direct changes in climate change drivers that we've seen over the last 100 to 150 years. A little bit about how we think those drivers will change in the next 100 years through the 21st century. I'll have a slide for those who like to see equations. I'll have one slide that says a little bit about radiative forcing. And I'll talk also about some of the natural influences on climate change that we need to identify as part of the story of both historic and potentially future climate change. So that's sort of where I'm going. I'll do much less with the bottom portion of the diagram. I won't talk extensively about biogeochemical feedback processes, although I'm happy to entertain any questions related to some of those. And I won't talk a lot about mitigation processes, although I will say some things about policy and different emission scenarios, so that some of the human activity will be included in my presentation. Next one, please, Tony. Well, we start this story by talking about the energy budget. And so this slide, which was taken from a piece by Jeffrey Keel and Kevin Trenberth in the late 1990s, published in the meteorological literature, was a summary of what we had been learning from both satellite-based and surface-based sources of getting at the radiative budget. On the left side of the diagram is the solar budget, what comes in from the sun, what is the fate of that solar radiation from everything from scattering to reflectivity to absorption in the atmosphere or reflectivity off the surface. And it turns out that about 70% of that solar radiation incoming to the top of the atmosphere stays within, and about 30% is lost immediately through reflectivity off of the Earth's surface, clouds, or other atmospheric constituents. On the right side of the diagram is the other part of the equation, and that is the long-wave budget, that is, cooler bodies like the Earth and the atmosphere both emit radiation as well, and they do so in what we call longer wavelengths because they are so much cooler than the sun, of course. The Earth is trying to achieve, and does achieve, an energy balance wherein the amount of energy coming in at the top of the atmosphere is equal to that being removed through long-wave radiation at the top of the atmosphere. So that balance is one that is adjusted to over slow or fast periods of time, and it keeps the planet relatively happy. Next slide, please, Tony.
I'm sorry to interrupt. Just a reminder to folks to put their phones on mute. I can hear some typing in the background. So if your phone does not have a mute button, please press *6 to mute and unmute. Thank you.
This diagram says a little bit about what would happen if certain constituents in the atmosphere, greenhouse gases or other atmospheric gases, were to change, what actually happens to that radiative budget? And what the diagram is trying to illustrate is that the loss of radiation through the atmosphere is retarded. It is slowed down in such a way that increasing greenhouse gases will reduce wave emission. Well, what that does, of course, is it slows down the rate of cooling that was achieved in that initial balance, and that initial balance is disrupted, and the only way that Earth can respond to that disruption is to increase surface and tropospheric temperature, that in the lower 15 kilometers or so of the atmosphere, increase the temperature so that the emission to space will increase. The question is, how fast does this actually happen? So a new balance of energy is achieved, but it's balanced. It comes at the expense of changing the temperature within the troposphere and at the surface. Question is, how fast does that happen, that adjustment happen? And that's referred to a term that we call radiative damping. That is, how quickly does this new energy balance get achieved? If it gets achieved relatively quickly, it means that the temperature is rather small. If it takes a while to reestablish this balance, then the temperature adjustment will be larger. Next one, please. So what do we know about the forcing of all the constituents in the atmosphere that may lead to a radiative or energy balance change that could cause temperature change? This diagram from the IPCC is a summary of all the things that we believe could do that, with some order of magnitude of how important each of them are. And even more important than that, it gives us some estimate of how sure we are about the forcing of these values. And this forcing should be interpreted as what has changed since about the year 1750 to the year 2005. How have a series of important greenhouse gases, ozone, aerosols, solar variability, and so forth, how have all those things collectively led to some change in the radiative balance? And so you can see in each of the cases a zero line, and this is radiative forcing expressed as power per area, right? So it's some intensity of energy we call radiative forcing in watts per meter squared. And everything to the right of the zero line means that there's increase in the energy within that tropospheric system. And everything to the left said there would be a decrease. And so you see on the diagram that what you would expect is that the greenhouse gases that exist in the atmosphere for prolonged periods of time have caused, as best we can estimate, somewhere on the order of 1.5 to 2 watts per meter squared change. That's CO2 alone. You can see other greenhouse gases, including methane, CH4, nitrous oxide, and halocarbons that include chlorofluorocarbons and other substances that are mostly anthropogenically produced. You see ozone is an important greenhouse gas, and you see the forcing due to air pollution over this 250-year period in the troposphere has led to more ozone, and in the stratosphere due to chlorine and ozone-depleting chemicals being released in the stratosphere, what we refer to as the ozone hole, particularly in the Antarctic and a bit in the Arctic, has reduced the amount of ozone, and so that's actually caused a little bit of cooling, you can see in the blue line. And I guess the only other thing that I wanted, the two other things I want to point out in this relatively busy diagram is that if you look at the aerosols present, aerosols are suspended particles that are often produced and often of sulfate nature, that are produced in a variety of ways, industrial ways particularly, that actually will cause a cooling. Sulfate aerosols released in the burning of fossil fuels, interestingly enough, are released and will actually cause increased scattering and reflectivity within the atmosphere. And so we believe and understand fairly well that this will lead to a cooling, a radiative cooling. Now, the important part of looking at this diagram is that there are two parts to the story. One is the direct effect, that is, the aerosols themselves can actually reflect the solar radiation. And secondly, those aerosols serve as condensation nuclei, which allow clouds to form. So cloud droplets need some nucleus, essentially, to for the condensation process to occur. And, of course, if there are more condensation nuclei in these aerosols, there will be more cloudiness. Now, if you look at both of those, we call those the direct and the indirect effects associated with aerosols. They are both causing a cooling, but you will see that the error bars represented by those little whiskers are not so little in this particular case. In fact, they are significantly larger than most of the other parts. And so this is part of the story that we don't completely understand. And I'll try to, in the presentation, point out what we're more sure about and the parts that we're less sure about. So that leads us to the bottom of the diagram, which is a total anthropogenic radiative forcing of about 1.5 watts per meter squared, as best we can estimate it, with error bars that are relatively large, and they are large largely because of the aerosol component of the story. So we'll move on from there, Tony. This diagram is a little bit busy, but it sort of gets at the complexity of this aerosol story. Why is it so complicated? It's so complicated because we don't know a whole lot about clouds, and we don't know a whole lot about the processes going on within them, and we don't know a whole lot about how aerosols either make more clouds, make clouds that are lower or higher in the atmosphere, or change the lifetime of cloud duration. So all those things are important because they will all affect the radiative budget in really important ways. So the complexity of this diagram gives you a sense of why those error bars are so large, is that the cloud formation process is very, very complicated and one that's very difficult for us to study because of where it is. Next one, please. Well, a little bit about I hope no one is turned off by the little bit of mathematics here. I just want to make a couple of general points, and that is if we take this radiative damping term, which is the lambda term at the top of this diagram, and we think about radiative forcing as delta R in that first equation, so we've got some sense of what a carbon dioxide doubling would mean in watts per meter squared. Again, the same units I was using on one of those earlier diagrams. If we were to double CO2 from pre-industrial levels, so let's say from 280 parts per million to 560 parts per million, that would cause a radiative warming of about 3.75 watts per meter squared. We understand the radiative damping term, that is how quickly the climate would adjust to those sort of radiative changes, to be on the order of about the same amount of 3.76 watts per meter squared per degree Kelvin. What it means is that if CO2 were to double, and that was the only thing that happened, that is, there were no feedbacks in the climate system, we would expect and be able to calculate fairly accurately that the Earth would warm on average about 1 degree Kelvin or 1 degree Celsius, same unit, right? Well, that's certainly small compared to many of the estimates that we commonly hear in the literature, and it's certainly small because, if you advance one more, Tony, there are feedbacks in the climate system. Let's illustrate two of them. First one is what happens with water vapor. If the Earth were to warm that 1 degree C because of the increasing CO2 or other greenhouse gases, it is likely that the rate of evaporation would increase. And water vapor, not shown on my previous diagram because it's not including some of the natural greenhouse gases, water vapor is a very effective greenhouse gas. So by increasing temperature, increasing the rate of evaporation, it is likely that the globe would have higher water vapor content. Water vapor would retard further the loss of long-wave energy, and the climate would adjust to a greater degree. And so you see, with water vapor alone, we get almost double the warming that we did just by the greenhouse gas increase itself. And then finally, if we include another important feedback, that is snow and ice on the planet diminishing as a result of that now almost 2 degrees Celsius warming, that the feedback would operate in such a way that less solar radiation would be reflected by the planet due to the melting. And for a variety of other complicated processes in the Arctic, would diminish the amount of long-wave loss and increase the amount of short-wave radiation that's actually received by the planet. And with these two feedbacks alone, we are now in the ballpark of the estimates that you commonly hear associated with increasing greenhouse gases in the 21st century of 2.5 to 3 degrees Celsius as our best estimate. That's where that number comes from. It's a process of the CO2 itself, which is a small amount, plus very logical feedbacks that we think we understand reasonably well. Anyway, enough of the math. Let's go to the next one, Tony. So we know greenhouse gases have increased over time. And so the question is, in our relatively short instrumental record of 150 years of temperatures on the globe, what have we seen in terms of changing temperature? You can see the graph at the top is showing the instrumental record for that 140 to 150 year period. And you see two particular increases in temperature, one starting in about 1900, leading to about the mid-1940s. And then a quiet period of 25 to 30 years where temperature didn't change dramatically. And then from the late 1970s to present, increasing temperatures again, leading to something on the order of about 0.6 degrees Celsius or about 1 degree Fahrenheit increase during this instrumental period, coming largely in those two particular times. Thankfully, we do have some proxy records that allow us to take the temperature estimates for the globe back farther in time. Farther back we go, of course, the coarser the resolution. And so the diagram at the bottom is showing our best estimate of temperature change for the last 1,000 years as a function of the instrumental record shown at the far right in red, and proxy measures that estimate the temperature of the Earth on the basis of a variety of paleo techniques, including geological techniques, chemical techniques, tree rings, and so forth, that give us an approximation because of the relationship between vegetation, for example, and temperature, or oxygen isotopes and temperature. How can we reconstruct the climate as best we can and take that back on the order of several hundred years at least to get a best estimate? So what we can see in this longer view, even the last 400 years or so from 1600 on, is that the temperatures we've experienced in the 20th century and now 21st century are considerably warmer than they've been at least for several hundred years from these relatively robust and in many cases independent proxy measures of temperature. Next one, please. Well, okay, that's great. So we've got some record in the historic observational record that tells us something about this relationship between increasing greenhouse gases and temperature. Now what we need to do is say, are the tools that we're going to provide projections for future climate change robust enough to actually do that task? And so one way we might test that is to take these general circulation models of the atmosphere, which are used to see how climate would respond to temperature, to some radiative forcing like increasing greenhouse gases. And could we, knowing how those gases have changed and how the radiative forcing has changed in the last 150 years or so, could we have predicted the temperature change that we would have experienced in the last 100 years? So what you see in the diagram here is a black line for each of the continents, excluding Antarctica, then summarized for the globe, and then summarized broken down by land versus ocean. There, the black line is representing our best estimate of the observations of temperature in the 20th century. The blue shaded area on each of these graphs is saying, what would a general circulation model say about how temperature should have changed in the 20th century if only natural forcings were common, were present? That is, if only solar variability, which we know is variable, and only volcanic activity, those main drivers of radiative forcing were the only things happening, what would we predict the temperature change to have been in the 20th century? And what you can see in this diagram is that that blue, the variability for each of the continents and then for the summary on the bottom, shows you know, some increasing in the early part of the century and some decreasing in the later part of the century, generally, depending where you are, and lots of wiggle through the 20th century. In fact, in most cases, you see a kind of mid-century peak, close to what we saw in that first diagram of the instrumental record, peaking sometime in the 1940s or so. Well, what you don't see in the blue shading is the increase in observed temperature that we have seen since 1975. This suggests, of course, that, in fact, the natural forcings of climate are not enough to explain the observed change that we've seen in the last 50 years. The pink shaded area says, now let's consider all those natural forcings plus the anthropogenic forcing that we'd see from increasing greenhouse gases. And what that's illustrating is that if we were to simulate the Earth's climate with these general circulation models and include all those forcings, in fact, we would have something that matches the observed record quite well. Well, that's a starting point, right? We need that minimum in order to trust these models for the future, and they certainly seem to meet that task. Tony, the next one, please. So let's say we tried the same experiment and now go back farther in time. That is, if we were to examine the reconstruction of climate from all those proxy measures that we talked about before and try to simulate the Earth's climate for a 700-year period, much of which is driven by natural forcing and part of which in the last portion is driven by anthropogenic greenhouse gas forcing. And what you can see is the same exercise and highlighted in the oval are all the reconstructions. And then in the gray line is an energy balance model taking into account volcanic, solar, and anthropogenic forcings. And what you see over time is that the best fit of the observed record comes from including all of those things. So we can capture the relatively unchanged portion of the first 600 years in that sequence, and you can see in the latter part of the 20th century, the energy balance model captures the change that we actually expect as a result of that greenhouse gas forcing. So it's a sort of same version of the previous one, but for the globe and for a much longer period of time. Gives us a fair amount of confidence, again, in the model. Well, let's take a look at a couple things with the next slide, please, Tony. In this diagram, I want to move from greenhouse gas emissions, which are shown on the left portion of the diagram, and the temperature response on the right portion. There's a lot going on in this diagram, and I think there are a few things to point out in particular. Many of you have heard of the various emission scenarios that we have for the 21st century. This comes from extensive work largely in the social science field, so from that first slide where we were referring to the estimates of future emissions that have a lot to do with human activity. If climate science is it contains some uncertainty, you can imagine the uncertainty associated with things that are going to be determined by changes in population, changes in standard of living, changes in the way in which we produce energy. All of these things are going to influence the emissions of greenhouse gases in the 21st century. Because there are a wide range of possibilities of all those variables, population, standard of living, fuel source, and so forth, there are a wide range of emission scenarios that we see. Without getting into the tail, the IPCC uses a series of abbreviations referring to a storyline associated with each. So just as one example, the light blue line in the diagram on the left is a scenario that's more or less a business-as-usual scenario, that is, population will increase steadily, standard of living for the globe will increase steadily, and we will be a fossil fuel-intensive world through much of the 21st century. And so you see the emissions associated with greenhouse gases going from on the order of 40 gigatons of CO2, increasing all the way to over 125 gigatons of CO2 by the latter part of the century. You can also see some emission scenarios that suggest that the way people live could change dramatically for any combination of decreasing population, perhaps, or leveling off, or changes in the efficiency of fuels, or changes in the carbon-focused-based fuels that we currently have. All those things could change, and so there are scenarios illustrated like the A1B in green and the purple line and the dark blue line, all of which are decreasing emissions after steady increases for the next few decades, decreasing in the latter half of the 21st century. Well, the result of that, you can follow on the right, is that every one of those emission scenarios leads to different concentrations of the greenhouse gas and a different surface temperature response to that greenhouse gas forcing. So what you see in the diagram on the right is a subset of the different scenarios, and you can match the colors on the left to the right to show how temperature changes would respond to each of those emission changes. And then finally, if we were somehow miraculously were able to keep CO2 concentrations at 370 parts per million as they were in year 2000, there would be some commitment, as we call it, to a warming that is expressed in the magenta line. Now, there are a couple of things I want to point out about this diagram on the right. There are two important things that I think are take-home messages. One of them is that if you look at the year about 2040, so another 30 years from now, if you look at the three lines, the red, the green, and the blue lines, all of which are associated on the left with very different emission scenarios. One is increasing fossil fuels all the way through the century. One is increasing steadily but then tapering off in the year 2050, and one of which tapers off a little sooner. These three emission scenarios are very, very different and would result from very, very different economic and social and energy-based solutions for the 21st century. We would notice, as human beings buying fuel and paying for fuel, we would notice very big differences in the way in which we live, or there would be a major change in technology in the next several decades that could lead to these kinds of changes. That said, and they would lead to very different emission scenarios. That said, notice when you go to the year 2040, notice the temperature difference in the response to those very different policy changes. So we could have very different emission scenarios through the 21st century, but the expression on the climate system is rather subtle in the next 30 or 40 years. Now, I mention this largely because many of the environmental policies that we think about are enacted, and we see results from them relatively quickly compared to this. Right, that is, we passed the Clean Water Act, and you go from rivers that are on fire to rivers that you can fish in again in a relatively short period of time. Clean Air Act, the same kind of thing, right? We see some relatively quick response. In this case, the response is far slower, and I'll come back to that point in a moment, but I want to at least put it out there while we look at this diagram. The second part of this diagram on the right that I want to illustrate is that you'll notice that these temperature estimates throughout the 21st century and then ending at their respective points in the year 2100 all have associated uncertainty. So the blue line has a blue bar associated with it, and the green line has a green bar, and so on and so forth. So we have a best estimate for these temperature changes, but we also have a range of possible and plausible estimates, and I'll come back to that issue in a moment. Next slide, please. So here's a combination of what you saw a moment ago, and I want to sort of take home the point one more time with the maps on the right of this diagram. Three different scenarios. Red, green, and blue, we'll call them right now. In the year 2025, the temperature changes greater in the polar regions because of feedback of snow and ice and lapse rate in that region are pretty subtle. The differences of these three emission scenarios is very small. On the right, you see what happens by the end of the century, and I think you would agree that the changes are not so subtly different anymore. So the point is, we don't see an immediate response to these policy changes, but we certainly, by the end of the century, see dramatic changes, both in the diagram on the left, which shows the temperature change from something less than 2 degrees C to something more than 3 degrees C, and on the maps on the right, where we see it more dramatically, especially in the polar regions. Next slide, please. So there are uncertainties associated with this issue. There are uncertainties associated with emissions, how things will change in the 21st century, and there are issues of uncertainty associated with the sensitivity. I showed you the water vapor and the snow feedback. There are a number of others, including those two, where we don't know the exact sensitivity of the Earth's climate to a change in CO2. We have a best estimate of about 3 degrees C, as I pointed out earlier, but it could range anywhere from 1.5 degrees C to something in excess, some people believe, as much as 8 to 10 degrees C. So the feedbacks are very, very important, and we don't understand them fully. It means, in the wake of this uncertainty, we need to be thinking probabilistically about this issue, and I think the next slide sort of illustrates it, please. So if we combine this probability of emissions, probability of climate sensitivity, we could come up with a probability density that says, all right, how would climate change in the future, and what is the likelihood of that change as a summation or a function of all of these things that we have not certainty about, but some probability. So I know that if I roll the dice, two dice, several times, I'm going to come up with seven. If I roll it enough, I'm going to come up with sevens as the total of those two dice more often than anything else. The question is, as we address this issue, should we be looking at the middle of this scenario? Should we be looking at the worst case scenario, that is, I roll 11s and 12s more regularly? Or should I be, you know, blindly optimistic and suggest that I'm always going to roll a 2 or a 3 in each of those
examples?
Climate is much more complicated than that, but it is a function of understanding these probabilities and trying to narrow that range. Next slide, please. So I want a couple of slides. This one in particular is trying to combine some of the uncertainty we have. It's a very busy diagram, but I think I can simplify it with a couple of strokes here. One is the solid black line is the observed temperature change since the year 1850. And again, you see the very characteristic early 20th century, late 20th century warming. Each of the other lines, dashed and dotted and thin, represent climate model expressions of how the temperature should have changed during that period of time. Each of them responds to different sensitivity of the Earth's climate, to a doubling, that's what the 2x means, of 1, 2, and 3 degrees C. Since we don't know what the sensitivity is exactly, let's try each of those three. And let's associate it with each of those three an offset that comes from aerosol cooling, which, again, we don't know precisely. And let's assume that that offset is 20, 40, and 60%. Respectively. What we would find is that if we combine that sensitivity with each of those offsets, any three of those climate models comes up with a reasonable approximation for the temperature changes that we've seen in the 20th century. We don't know which one's right, but we know all of them, all of these models are very plausible expressions of those kinds of changes. Next one, please. I think you got to advance a couple of them. We could do the same thing with things like the height of the tropopause. We can model that fairly well. We know it responds to volcanoes. The models capture that very well, and we can look at the kind of changes that we see through time. So I'll go through the next one, please. We can also do the same thing with water vapor. We can estimate water vapor changes. We can model them. We can observe them and come up with the same kind of estimates. This graph is particularly important because of what I said about water vapor being an effective greenhouse gas. We want to make sure we're modeling it right, right? Because of that feedback that's so important. And this diagram shows that we are modeling it very, very closely. And then if we go forward, the next series of diagrams that I want to finish up with these last five slides relate to some of the projections that we've taken in our work here to investigate temperature and precipitation changes in the Southeast. All of these are centered around the last three decades of the 21st century. And you can see from this diagram, I think you have to advance one more, Tony, to get the legend a little bit more legible. There you go. And so you'll see in this example the annual temperature changes associated with each of those colors on the map. These are four different general circulation models showing the southeastern United States. And you can see for the annual temperature changes at the end of the 21st century that these projections are anywhere from 1 to more likely 2 to 4 degrees C warming. Advance one more, please. You see the same thing for 9 different GCMs now. Again, the same kind of range that I showed you a moment ago. I'm going to center for the next slide on the Carolinas, which are outlined by the grid cell I'm showing in white on this diagram. So one more diagram gets us to that projected temperature changes. If we used 11 general circulation models, took the grid cells that are within North and South Carolina, the end of the century, and a particular emission scenario that is kind of a middle-of-the-road scenario, these are the annual temperature changes that we can see. Again, you can see my love of sort of doing it as a probability function. I'm showing a histogram that shows the wide range of opinion, wide range of output of these GCMs, but we can surmise from that the increase is pretty consistent in between 2 and 5 degrees Celsius warming. Next slide, please, shows a little bit from the precipitation. So I'm doing the same thing with this. I think you have to advance one more and see some of the legends. And again, the legend's kind of small to read, so I've superimposed it on the appropriate colors, and you can see a variety of modest increases in precipitation in the southeast to some scenarios that are actually drying. Advance one more, and we summarize them together. And we see that most of the models call for modestly wetter conditions in the southeast. A few call for drier conditions. And what I want to do in the final slide is show what if we were to combine temperature increasing on the lower end of that estimate I showed you a moment ago, so just over 2 degrees C, and getting 15% wetter in every month of the year. The historic record of evaporation is shown with the blue bars on this diagram. The estimate for the end of the 21st century on the basis of that 2.2 degrees warmer and 15% wetter is showing how evaporation rates would change. And the reason I'm showing this is that, you know, we don't know as much because of the complexity of clouds. We don't know how precipitation is likely to change in the 21st century as we do temperature. So if we were to believe the 15% wetter, it would be swamped by the 2-degree warming that we've imposed on here. That is, the availability of soil moisture, the availability of water in streams and so forth would be diminished even with an increase of 15% precipitation because of the warming and the greater atmospheric demand for that water at the surface.